Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
What is the closest we've got to the perfect driver? It can be past or present.
That's a pretty brutal question.
Fernando Alonso in those Ferrari years is for me the closest we've had to perfection.
Lewis has also buried guys.
Peak Lewis is tough to beat as well.
Peak Lewis is really impressive.
I think Lewis 2007 was even more impressive than Lewis 2008.
He can't have been the best version of himself when he turned up.
Hinch, what about attitude?
I'm going to go with like the Max Verstappen approach and attitude in the car.
I was looking at a Max and someone like Michael Schumacher.
What about marketing and media then?
It's nice to have someone that's got a big personality and waltzes into Austin on a horse, great. That's coming at the cost of something else though.
If Max leaves Red Bull, where's his most likely destination?
I think Max only leaves if he's going to Mercedes.
So the only other one I'm thinking is, you're going to be surprised by this, but Ferrari.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to F1 Nation. I'm Tom Clarkson, and joining me on the show, as usual, is former F1 driver Jolyon Palmer and IndyCar race winner James Hinchcliffe. Guys, good to see you. Now, last week, we reacted to the news that Max Verstappen's race engineer, Giampiero Lambiassi, is leaving Red Bull and joining McLaren. We also talked about how that might impact Max's future at the team. And I asked both of you, if Max were to leave and you were Red Bull team principal Laurent Mekies, who would you pick to replace him? JP, you said Leclerc. Hinch, you said Piastri. And that micro disagreement got me thinking, because I'm intrigued by the fact that you both picked a different driver. So let's start today's show by discussing what makes the perfect F1 driver. First of all, does that person exist?
Well, probably not, do they? Because there's always someone that's better than the best that's out there. If you put AI out there in some form, if you ticked all the boxes to 100, they'll be better than the almost perfect best drivers out there. So I think you have to say that there's potential for anyone to be better. But there are some really talented drivers out there at the moment that are pushing it.
It kind of depends on what categories you want to break down, right? I mean, I agree with JP. Nobody's perfect, right? There's always going to be an area that somebody can improve on. I do want to also caveat that I did last week say that I was also thinking Leclerc, but I went with a backup option just for the sake of the conversation. So we were still somewhat aligned there. But no, I think if you want to genuinely create the perfect all-round Formula One driver, there's a bunch of different categories, you know, I think that you have to address. And I think you could pull traits from a bunch of drivers that we all know and combine them to make the best, because I don't think one driver has it all.
Let's break it down then into some categories. Why don't we start with physique, tall, short? What do we want?
Wow, I didn't think we were going to start on the physical part of it. That's one thing I hadn't thought about.
Well, Adrian Newey will tell you that, you know, you want the smallest, lightest driver. Okay, there's now a prescribed weight limit for the driver. But back in the day, it was all about having jockeys driving these cars. That's what Adrian wanted. So that doesn't apply now, though, right?
When I was racing, you still wanted to be a jockey in the car. So that was in the era before we had the weight limit that's now set at 80 kilos. So I was coming in at 73 with kit, as lean as I could be at over 6 foot. But then, you know, I was always one of these tall drivers that was pushing for, let's have a mandated minimum weight limit because it's not healthy. We're not eating any calories. We're going dehydrated into the races. And then you'd have little Felipe Massa, I don't know, 56 kilos with kit saying, no, this is how it is. This is how it's always been. So even up until my day, oh man, it's a killer for the taller drivers. So now Now that rule came in, sadly, shortly after I stopped racing. I think it might have been even the year after, in 2018, which kind of negates the maximum gain that the small drivers can take. But you still, if you want to be pernickety about it, you still get weight down low. If you had a smaller driver, if you had a small, you've got to be a little bit stocky because you've got to be strong to drive these cars as well. But then sometimes, you know, taller drivers sit a bit higher and they get a better viewpoint of curbs and those sort of things as well. So even your Yuki Tsunodas can't sit absolutely on the bottom. They still have to sit up. But I guess they've got a little bit of weight down low, which must be a marginal gain.
Hinch, what about attitude then? If we're going to continue to categorize these guys,
are we taking Yuki's kind of physique? Is that where we're starting?
I think, yeah, that's fair. I mean, I was kind of with you that it's not as physique again was a category that caught me off guard to open with, but yeah, even with the weight limit, you are right. There is still a small advantage, no pun intended.
Do you reckon that you could do a? Do you reckon you could do a like a taller driver, a George Russell, maybe you could even go as far as saying an Esteban Ocon, but with massive legs and massive glutes. So you've still got that weight low down, but you've got a little bit more height in the car to get the perspective as well. Can we fine-tune this?
We're getting very, very specific. No, because here's the thing. Your perspective about the higher drivers is good, but I think there's still an aero thing. I do look at George drive around. He does look so much higher in the car. I bet there's an aerodynamicist somewhere back at Mercedes HQ thinking, man, I wish that helmet sat a little bit lower in the car. So I still, from an aero standpoint, think, you know, maybe it's an advantage on street circuits. You know, I always like being maybe a mil or two higher in your seat on a street circuit for that sort of visual line of things. But no, I still think, okay, we'll go with a roughly Yuki size driver.
You introduce the next category, Hinch.
Well, I mean, you had said attitude, so we can carry on down that path. And I think that even has two subsections, right? I think you have to have the on-track attitude, and then I think you have to have the off-track attitude. I do think those two can be different. I think a lot of drivers have, I don't want to say different personalities. I really do think your personality out of the car translates to who you are and how you drive inside the car to a certain extent. But I think there's always an extra bit of an edge, right? Once the helmet goes on and you know, look, JP's the nicest guy in the world, but I'm sure when he was out in a Grand Prix, it was, you know, elbows up when needed to be and could be that killer instinct. So I think you need, this will be a good one. This will get JP and I on a track here. I'm going to go with like the Max Verstappen approach and attitude in the car in terms of that relentless pursuit of the absolute nth degree, driving to within that fraction of a limit of the rules, sometimes maybe once or twice a season beyond. But I think that he is, you know, his approach in the race car is just so fully committed. That kind of attitude in the car, I think, is crucial.
I sort of agree to the most extent. I was thinking in terms of like your relentless pursuit of perfection in the car, your don't settle for second, don't settle for anything less than the maximum you can possibly get. I was looking at a Max and someone like Michael Schumacher. What they've both got in common is a level of controversy where they've pushed the rules too far because they've been so desperate for executing the absolute maximum, rather than necessarily accepting on any given day that it's not on, that's not the move. They'll try something that will then get them into trouble. So that's where, I don't know, the line of how you want to be as a racing driver. I guess it depends on your own ethics and morals there with how much you're willing to risk. I mean, and certainly in Schumacher's case, reputation as well at times. When you look at Jerez 97 and certainly, so like the RAS cast, we're talking big, big things that have happened in the past. And Max is 21 as well. You know, there was a lot of big moments where he was getting penalty after penalty, or at least conversational penalties in the past as well, not quite on Schumacher's level. So that you can see in the multiple world champions, that trait of I will win, I will find a way to make something work, that I think other drivers probably don't quite have that last 1%. Whether you necessarily want the last 1% is down to a personal preference, I guess.
Is it an ice cold attitude, or is it passion? Do you need passion as well in the Jean Alesi mold?
For me, it's like it's just a clinical. Can I make this move? And if it's even feasible that I might as well try it. It's kind of just an absolute desire for success. It's the second doesn't cut it sort of mentality. Whereas I think other drivers, like I said, would probably not have that, I'm going to ruffle so many feathers by going for this. So I'm going to, this could be a risky one. This could be, I do think when you look at Max, you look at Schumi, you see drivers that will take chances on getting penalties, on getting it wrong to actually win a race that other people wouldn't win.
It's never settling.
Yeah.
Right? It's the never settling attitude, right? Whether you're racing for seventh and eighth or first and second, the attitude from this driver behind the wheel is the same. Their approach is the same. Any car in front is a car that should be behind, and they're going to do anything in their power to get there.
This episode is sponsored by Indeed. You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. So how do you find the right candidate fast? Easy. You use Indeed. Instead of your job posts getting buried in a sea of listings, Indeed Sponsored Jobs helps you stand out and hire faster. Your listing jumps to the top of search results so the right candidates see it first. And it really works. According to Indeed data, Sponsored Jobs posted directly on Indeed get 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, there's no monthly subscription, no long-term contract. You only pay for results. One of the things I love about Indeed is how quick and efficient it is. Hiring can feel overwhelming, but with sponsored jobs, the process moves faster and you attract stronger candidates. There's no need to wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a £100 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/F1Nation. Just go to Indeed.com/F1Nation right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/F1Nation. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring, Indeed is all you need.
Okay, so in car, you guys are mentioning Schumacher and Verstappen. What about outside the car, just while we're talking attitude? You know, a willingness to do all the marketing stuff and talk to the media. How important is that today? I mean, I'll sit here and claim it's really important, but is it really if you're a world championship winning racing driver? You just do your talking on the track, right?
No, not in F1 2026. And again, I think this one kind of needs to be cut down into two different categories, because I look at it as off track, who you are within the race team. And then off track, who you are with that media kind of hat on and all the commitments required there in mind. If we want to start with the former, you know, the attitude that these drivers bring to the race teams has a tremendous effect and a tremendous impact, I think, on the outcome of the team. You know, I've said a million times in a million conversations that racing's not about cars or engines or tires, it's about people, right? And if you get the right group of people and you motivate them properly, they can do incredible things. And for me, when I think back of drivers that really had a handle on knowing how to get the best out of their team, I would probably go with Schumacher on that one. I've heard so many stories from people, you know, that worked at Ferrari at the time or worked at Mercedes when he had a stint there. I've heard other drivers say it as well. Whatever you thought of him in front of a microphone, whatever you thought of him, you know, behind the wheel, Michael had a unique talent in really rallying the troops, right? Really getting the race team behind him, demanding and expecting the absolute best out of them, but doing it in a way where that's also what they wanted to do. And they felt empowered to do it. And they felt like, you know, they would be appreciated for the effort. So I know I've heard Vettel say that he sort of modeled his approach after that, and that worked quite well. There was actually just recently an article interviewing Sam Bird, who was the Mercedes reserve driver when Schumacher was there. And that was one of the points that he made, even late in his career. He was one of the guys that just really knew how to get the team behind him. And I think that's so important.
I thought you were about to give Sam Bird the biggest leg up there. You got, you know, Schumacher, you've got Vettel, you've got Sam Bird. I thought that was a curveball that I didn't see in this conversation.
Maybe he saw that, and that's how he. I've not worked with him. I don't know personally, but maybe.
he saw obviously. Yeah, Schumi, as you said, in those days, Vettel was the driver that I was thinking of actually in more recent terms, because you want to be you want to be the team leader, don't you? You want to be galvanizing of everyone in the garage that they all know that they're pulling for you. You're working really hard. You are staying late. You're knowing the team inside out. That includes everyone in the garage. Loads of the people in the factory understanding exactly who does what, how things are put together. And it's hard work doing that anyway, before you even get onto like your driving and focusing on the absolute, you know, your basics of what's going to make you quicker, actually just galvanizing everyone else. And I think Seb was a driver that was very good from early on at coming in and just understanding the people in the team.
Red Bull, yes. Do you think Seb had the same effect at Ferrari?
Certainly initially, I think he did, yeah. I think you saw the spring in his step when he changed over to Ferrari. He was there alongside Kimi, and I just felt like the team was rallying around Seb very early. Obviously, then he had the couple of years where he had quite a few spins and incidents from title-winning-ish positions, and then it starts to unravel a little bit. But I still think he had the support of the team pretty well until Charles Leclerc came in and did a great job. And I think that's the personality that you saw from Red Bull. It, again, probably dwindled a little bit when Ricciardo came in at the last year of Red Bull and Seb was maybe just waning in that motivation. Moved to Ferrari, and I think you saw the same process happening again.
Okay, so what about marketing and media then?
It's tough to not look to Lewis, you know, in the sense that, you know, in a global sport, in the way the world is in 2026, you know, he brings an attention and kind of bring, I think he really helped bring F1 into sort of the pop culture zeitgeist, right? Yes, there are times where you put a microphone in front of him and he doesn't necessarily give you what, as a member of the media, you're looking for. You know, he's human at the same time. So I think the profile and the willingness to kind of almost go above and beyond just the media commitments of Formula One and to do more to help grow the sport, I think Lewis was great in that. But, and this might be an unpopular take, but I'd say a little bit of Lando Norris, because what I love out of Lando is the honesty that you get when the microphone's in front of him. You know, you feel like you're talking to a human being. Drivers for so long were just beaten into this kind of PR, you know, mold of here's the line you have to say, here's what you can and can't say, things like that. And Lando was breaking some of those rules in a good way. He was being very honest about his own shortcomings. And when you spoke to him, you knew you were going to get an honest and sometimes emotional response. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I agree with that. My one thing is I don't know if, because I was thinking when you talk like media personalities, how people are in front of camera, and Daniel Ricciardo is someone that springs to mind. Right, what a character.
Yeah, that was another one, yeah.
When things are going well and Danny Rick's in happy, bubbly Danny Rick style, you're thinking this guy is really bringing an extra energy and a vibrancy around Red Bull, particularly in those days. With all of it, though, you have to think, how much of that is actually important for a racing driver? It's important for their own personal brand, but if I'm a team looking to sign someone, I guess the brand is important, so Lewis brings a huge amount to Ferrari. And your Danny Rick in the past would have bought a lot in terms of character and personality, but it doesn't necessarily help you on the track. So there's a sort of split there with, it's nice to have someone that's got a big personality and waltzes into Austin on a horse, great. That's coming at the cost of something else though. You've been trying out the horse, but you could have probably arrived 15 minutes earlier and said hello to everyone in the garage or, you know, something. There's all of these guys, time is finite. So it's trying to find the balance between it all.
What about intelligence? Is that important? I mean, I love interviewing Fernando Alonso because he has a ferocious intellect and you got to be on your A game to have a proper conversation with him. And I'm sure that translates into everything he does, whether it's talking about the car to an engineer or doing the media commitments we've just been talking about. I would argue quite strongly that all the greats are intelligent. Would you agree with that?
Difficult to tell, isn't it, what quantifies as intelligence? Like when we speak to people, I think their experience gives you like a level of intelligence, of knowing what to do just by sort of growing up and experiencing things and understanding, you know, wrong paths to take the right path. I find it difficult to say, you know, who is intelligent and who's not necessarily. Everyone has their own ways of working. I would have thought, you know, on the face of it, intelligence makes a good difference. But then is there definitely a correlation between success in a Formula One car and intelligence? I don't know if there's that much correlation. But and it depends how you define intelligence.
But an ability to absorb information and react to it.
Of course. That's like the most important thing in the game, isn't it? And when you hear all the driver chatter and everything, is that necessarily... I guess it's like, is that intelligence or is that like having an ability to compute things? I guess I'm rambling now, but maybe that is a part of it. There's whether it's like you're like book smart, intelligent, like with a high IQ, or whether you can process things in different ways. That's what I'm saying. There's loads of different ways to be intelligent.
Yeah, I don't think you need a master's degree to be a great Formula One driver. But no, I think I know what you're trying to say there, TC, and I do agree. I've had experiences in my career, and for obvious reasons, I won't name names, where I raced against drivers that were just, they were massively talented, right? And they got to a certain part of the sport off the back of pure ability. They had no idea why they were fast. They had no idea how they were fast. They were just fast. You put them in a machine, they will drive the wheels off it, probably faster than anybody else could. But if the machine's not perfect, they don't know how to make it better, right? They don't understand where their strengths are. So to me, that racing intelligence, that driving intelligence comes from that understanding of the car. A formula car is a very complex machine. Understanding how it works at different phases of a corner, at different phases of a stint, that does take some need of general intelligence, right? You need to have a bit of a grasp of engineering, you know, of mechanical engineering, of aerodynamic engineering. So I do think so. I think anytime you get a driver with boatloads of natural talent, I guess to end that part of the story, they have so much ability, they don't know why they're fast, and ultimately their career plateaus because you get to a level where you have these drivers that have massive amounts of talent, but also are wildly intelligent, and you put them together. And yes, the first person that comes to mind to me was also Fernando Alonso. We talk a lot about Max Verstappen's, you know, extra capacity in the car. I do think that's an intelligence indicator. Guys like George Russell, Carlos Sainz, we talked about this in the past. I really do think that intelligence is a key part of it, especially, you know, in the more modern area of Formula One, just because these cars are getting so much more complex and understanding all the systems to be able to maximize everything to that last 10th, 100th is crucial.
You've put that way more eloquently than me, Hinch. I guess it's important to have.
We're not
it.
Talking about pub quizzes here.
No, but what I would say is I to give props to Sergei Sorokin, because he was super intelligent and he sat in for me, Magnussen, back in the day in FP1s. And you could see his intelligence working and he'd sit in the debrief and give like the most thorough debrief for a guy that's just sat in the car. And I think he had gone to uni and you know, he was a book smart driver that was super thorough with his debriefs. You could see the intelligence, and obviously he didn't have the longevity of career, but that's probably because he didn't have the talent of the other guys.
Right.
So he was probably one of the smartest guys I came across in Formula One in terms of the debriefs and the intensity of work. But obviously he had, you know, one of the shortest careers.
You know that Williams used to set an engineering test for all new drivers.
Yeah.
I just found that interesting that they felt you did it.
I did.
What kind of questions?
I did. It was all sorts of...
You're 100% man, weren't you?
So I remember doing it, and there was a question that I sort of didn't make any sense. I think I got one thing wrong. It was loads of like data traces, loads of plots, and everything. But it was a fascinating thing. But anyway, I won't go into the detail of that. I don't even know if they still do that.
But JP, I find it interesting that a team felt the need to test their drivers in that way.
Isn't that quite a Williams thing as well, though? It's a sort of, I feel like it's a legacy from Frank Williams, Patrick Head, the minds that set it up of like an old school, we want intelligent drivers, we want drivers that can understand exactly what we want from a car and all of this stuff. It's certainly a benchmark for when you're going to sign as a driver, then, you know, let's see who we're dealing with here. And it was genuinely 50 questions. It was a really good test because there were questions that would...
Give us an example of a question in the Williams test.
You'd get like a data trace and there'd be all sorts of plots. And one would be like, let me know when the car goes over a bump. And there'd be a damper plot that goes but there'll be amongst loads of other lines, and you'd have to work out what was the, where was the bump on the data. So that was like quite a, probably on the more challenging end of it. And there were various, just all sorts of like technical questions.
I want to take this test so bad. Do you think if I asked Jake Vallis, he'd send me like the PDF? And if we, that would be great. You should, you, me and JC and Brundle all do the test.
That's the new pub quiz. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, brilliant. Guys, are there any other categories we haven't spoken about in what makes the perfect Formula One driver?
It's the big one, isn't it? It's like talent. So it's a feel for grip. And that's, for me, more than any of these sort of like your brain function, your physique, it's having this sixth sense for grip. And it's a feel through your body of how hard you can push into any corner. Feel the micro slides on the front axle, the rear axle. Know then how much opposite lock or you know, steering input, brake input, pedal input to catch the slides. That's the magic. All of these things, I think we're talking about the last 10%. The 90% is in, I would say, like a natural feel. Or let's say 60% of that is a natural feel. 30% of that is experience and seat time as well. That's, for me, the magic beyond all of it. So when I come up with the Sergei Sorokin example...
How do you quantify that? Is that just the stopwatch tells you whether a driver's got that? Or is it feedback?
No, I think it's... Well, there's a little bit back into feedback, but it's fundamentally, it's the stopwatch, isn't it? And it's your ability to be quick without crashing, your ability to then be quick when it rains and you're on slicks and you need to just suddenly switch on the, hang on, we're now going 15 seconds a lap slower, but I can't afford to be 16 seconds a lap slower. So I need to be on the limit of this grip now, but who the heck knows where the grip is? And that is when you see the ultimate skill set of the driver, which is literally a natural feel for grip through your body, knowing what the tires, what the car is saying to you, and driving to the limit of that. And that's what let me down, because I didn't have it as much as the rest of them.
So who is it then?
When you look at all of the greats, they've got most of these attributes that we're talking about, or all of them. And then you're talking like this feel for grip. And with different eras, it's just so difficult to challenge. I mean, obviously, someone like Senna had this in abundance. When you look at his old drives in the Lotus, in the Tolman, they're the magical days where you realize this guy is unbelievably skilled. And then, of course, gets into McLaren and figures it all out. Fernando, for me, ticks so many boxes. When it rains, when it's whatever, he's able to get, I think there was a quote a while ago where he could get 9 out of 10 in all of these scores, and it makes him a formidable challenger. Then you've got Lewis, absolutely. Max, completely, you know, all of the greats. But to try and, I don't know, go on, Hinch, are you going to pluck a name?
No, I mean, I mean, Senna was the first thought, and then Max was the second, just because Senna, for all the obvious reasons, right? We've all the races you just mentioned, we've watched the onboards, we know what it's like. For me, the thing that always stood out about Max, you know, was these last few seasons, the first run of FP1, he'd be a second clear of the field. That would eventually get to within a tenth or two of him. But that ability to feel the grip when the grip was on the lower side, you know, he would immediately, and then you look at the drives in the rain the last few seasons that we've seen from him, unreal. But it's funny you mentioned Fernando, because I was going through all this while we're sitting here, and I was like, it's weird that we haven't brought his name up more, because I feel like he is a lot of these things as well. And if there's one category I'll add to it to finish it off, it would be just pure racecraft. Right, the wheel-to-wheel ability to battle, come out on top. He's, for me, as good as I've seen. You know, I think back to peak Alonso in 05, 06, and then even late Alpine, early Aston Alonso still had some incredible races. Wasn't racing for the win anymore, but some of the drive, some of the way he could control a battle from in front or behind, so, so impressive. One of the best at it.
Yeah.
It's almost his ability to keep cars behind that was more impressive than overtaking cars in front.
It's like he could see the future sometimes. He reads racecraft so well that he will calculate before you get to a corner, say, I'm going to brake here. If you brake later than me, fair play, but you won't turn the corner from there. So this is where I'm going to position it, and this will see me come out of the corner ahead. And the same when you look at his race starts, he will position his car so often just in the perfect spot where he'll cover off the inside. He'll know that anyone that breaks later than that will go in deep. He'll be probably avoiding the collision that will inevitably happen there. And he just has this foresight into racing. And certainly there was such a difference in caliber when I was racing. I was racing him in the McLaren Honda days. And he was a cut above. Honestly, he was. I've sort of prided myself on my racecraft coming through GP2, and I thought I was not bad. But you'd race him, and I was taught a lesson or two a few times. He was something else.
JP, the great irony about Alonso, and he admits this himself, is that he says, "I probably am not the fastest over one lap. My big day is Sunday." And to go back to your point about talent, surely that is manifested most on a Saturday, that feel for grip over one lap in qualifying. You know, we think of Senna's 1988 pole lap at Monaco, where he was 1.5 seconds faster than Prost. And yet we're eulogizing about Alonso, whose speciality was 56 laps on a Sunday.
Yeah, but he's not bad on a Saturday, is he? I think he's maybe not the absolute fastest there's ever been, but he's not far away. And then when you do think racecraft, you think it's kind of judgment. These are like split-second judgment decisions. When you're coming into a corner, you're in the slipstream of the car ahead, and you're thinking, can I, can't I? If you dither in those moments, you get it wrong, you crash. You have to be clinical, and you just have to have that clarity of thought. And maybe it's the back to your intelligence and having that in the car, which I think he's got an abundance of. Also, reactions, something else, just plain and simple. His starts, his ability to catch moments. You might feel the grip, but you've got to then react as quick as possible, and you know, moving scenarios as well. When you look at even Colapinto, that start in Melbourne when he almost rear-ended Liam Lawson, having those reactions is got to be right up there as well.
Okay, so guys, we've mentioned Schumacher, we've mentioned Senna, we've mentioned Prost, Alonso, Hamilton, Verstappen, Norris. One driver, please, from each of you. What is the closest we've got to the perfect driver? It can be past or present.
I was thinking about this. Fernando Alonso in those Ferrari years is, for me, the closest we've had to perfection. Especially 2012, when he nearly won the title. But that was when I thought he is ticking all of these boxes, the consistency of it as well. It's not necessarily, I mean, he's obviously not had the more than the two-time world championships, and things have gone away from him, and he's not necessarily been a galvanizing force all the time. But in that window, I thought at Ferrari, that is just such a brilliant all-round picture of a Formula One driver, I think.
Yeah, that's a tough one. That's a tough one to answer, TC. That's a pretty brutal question. That's a really good response, though. Alonso in the Ferrari years, I think, is right there. I think Vettel in the Red Bull years is pretty close as well, because, you know, I know the car had its advantages, but you think back to, you know, how they finished off 09 and then, you know, the subsequent championships. You mentioned the point, JP, about his way to kind of the way he rallies the team and was a team leader. He was beating a very talented driver, you know, a multiple Grand Prix winner. He was up against a pretty strong teammate in his tenure there. But then, you know, Lewis is also buried guys, you know, in those similar situations. I don't know.
Peak Lewis is tough to beat as well.
Peak Lewis is really impressive. So,
when was peak Lewis? When was peak Lewis, do you think?
I knew you were going to follow up with as soon as I said that. So I would say 2008 was Lewis coming in with aplomb, and some of the drives he put in that year, obviously won the title right at the end. But when you think back to Silverstone, when he was clearly a class ahead of the rest, and he nearly lapped the whole field, didn't he? And a few other drives around that time, the skill set that he had the team fully singing off his hymn sheet.
Can I counter this, JP? Can I counter this? I think Lewis 2007 was even more impressive than Lewis 2008. In his first year, was it 9 consecutive podiums? I know the McLaren that year was very good, but 9 consecutive podiums to start his Formula One career. He went round the outside of Fernando Alonso at the first turn in Melbourne, the first race. He was perfect, actually, for those first 9 races for, in his debut season.
Yeah, yeah.
Go on, come up with a better season. I mean, you think 2008.
Well, I think we're also completely disregarding the Mercedes years here because of young Lewis. He was so exciting when he came in. But when you think of Hamilton in those earlier Mercedes years, some of his drives then as well, you think of the Bahrain one with Rosberg coming out on top, and we think about this Fernando, the tactics and all the racecraft. That was such a display, as well as having pace. The races at the end of 16, I know he didn't win the title, but when he went on that run and he had to win every race to try and beat Nico, the Brazil Grand Prix, where we think so much about Max, but Lewis just romped it in a different league as well. That was an unbelievable part of his career, and he just wasn't massively challenged, so it's difficult to quantify it there, but you could still see the skill that he had.
Right, so JP, you're still staying with Alonso in the Ferrari,
I think, as a patch. I'll go Alonso Ferrari
2012. Yeah. Hinch, are you going Hamilton then?
Yeah, I might go Hamilton 07. I was with you on that one. As a rookie, I would argue, JP, that he was probably better in 08 because you've got that year of experience. That's just a natural thing to happen. But the relative performance and the fact that he did it as a rookie in 2007.
Alongside Alonso.
Alongside a guy that we were literally just talking, preaching all of his strong attributes, coming off his double. He was the back-to-back rating world champion, and he nearly got owned by a rookie.
But guys, he can't have been. I know what you're saying. I was watching it as well. It was amazing. He can't have been the best version of himself.
I agree.
When he turned up. That's the only thing. You have to say it was amazing. But he must have got a little bit better. The competition just changed, didn't it?
Yes, yes. And that's why I think everybody leveled up. He did as well. But that one stands out to me still as just one of the most impressive seasons of anyone ever.
Okay, and I'm going to throw in Senna in 1993. If you can remember that. Can you remember that?
Yeah.
Just, you know, in that McLaren.
I was two.
Up again. Oh, you were two. But up against, you know, the all-conquering Williams that year, Donington 93, when he went from fifth to first in the rain, just that hunger. We've sort of referenced hunger in a lot, really, in this chat, and just that desire, that hunger, the ability, that feel for grip back to Donington as well. Just that was, I felt that was peak Senna. He was out to prove something. He wanted that Williams drive for the following year, and he made. He made his case. He made Frank Williams had to employ him. He had to, I'm afraid, although Alain Prost has a contract for 1994, we're actually going to replace him with Ayrton Senna, because how can you not, ultimately, it was the case.
This episode is sponsored by Quince. This time of year is always a bit tricky when it comes to choosing what to wear. One minute, it feels like spring has properly arrived. The next, you're reaching for an extra layer again. My wardrobe definitely needs to reflect that. A few reliable pieces that work across different situations and still feel comfortable to wear. And I'm sure it's the same for a lot of you listening. Well, Quince is the first place you should look. They focus on high-quality everyday essentials made with premium materials like 100% European linen and their incredibly soft Flowknit activewear fabric. Their linen pants and shirts are lightweight and breathable, exactly the kind of pieces that make sense when the weather starts warming up, but you still want something versatile. And their Flowknit activewear is designed with comfort in mind too, moisture wicking, anti-odor, and the kind of thing you could easily wear all day. And what's interesting about Quince is how they keep their prices so reasonable. Their pieces are often 50 to 60% less than similar brands because they work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen. So you're paying for quality materials, not brand markups. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Go to quince.com/nation for free shipping and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. Go to Quince, quince.com/nation for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/nation. Let's talk very briefly now just about the driver market for 2027. Max has a contract with Red Bull that lasts until 2028, but he does have performance clauses in it, which means he can move elsewhere if he's not in a certain position in the championship by a certain time.
Firstly, is Verstappen the first domino that needs to fall if we're going to have a driver market frenzy in the summer?
He's the biggest one, definitely. I think if something happens there, then is whether he moves to another team, in which case we've definitely got a frenzy on our hands. And if he doesn't, but he leaves, then there's a space at Red Bull which could see an opportunistic driver elsewhere move there. So I think he's the most topical at the moment. And we said last week is probably fairly likely that he'll move at this point. So I think that's where everyone's going to be looking right now.
Well, just so quickly, so if he stays, are we expecting quite a quiet market, at least at the sharp end? Do we think the top four teams, if Max stays at Red Bull, will remain with their current lineups?
I would think so. You know, I would think so. I think everybody in those teams is performing at a decent level. I don't think Lewis is stopping, you know, because that's kind of the obvious one, right? Was Lewis going to wait to see how the new Ferrari was? And if it wasn't great, he'd hang it up. And then Behrman sort of got a seat waiting for him at Ferrari. But it seems like we're seeing some old Lewis. Ferrari's done a good job with the car. So I would imagine the front half is probably pretty static. I could see a decent amount of movement in the back half regardless, though.
I think Lewis is probably the biggest question mark. If Max stays at Red Bull, I think it's whether Lewis carries on. He's 41 as well. And it'll be whether he keeps up this level of performance throughout into the sort of contract part of the season in the summer. And whether he believes that Ferrari can deliver him a title still, and if he still has the hunger to go at it. At the moment, I agree with you, Hinch. I can see him staying on and all parties seem happy, but 41-year-old Lewis there maybe is the bigger question mark. The Mercedes and McLaren guys won't change unless Verstappen enters the fray. And I think if anything did happen to Lewis, I think it would be a fairly slam-dunk Ollie Behrman promotion, assuming Behrman carries on his trajectory as well.
If Max leaves Red Bull, where's his most likely destination? Is it Mercedes, you know, given all the conversations he's had with them over the past 18 months, 24 months?
Well, it's basically Toto Wolff being put in the same position that Frank Williams was put in, isn't it? You know, because Toto's got two very high-performing drivers, two drivers that he has brought up through the sport and groomed into be, you know, very well-rounded, performing Formula One drivers. But there was just so many sound bites from last season of, you know, him dreaming of working with Max. How could you not have the conversation? Now, how much of that is politicking? How much of that was just trying to, you know, destabilize the Red Bull camp? Very likely, right? It's very possible. I think Max only leaves if he's going to Mercedes because Max just wants to win and it doesn't seem like the advantage they have is going anywhere anytime soon. So if he's anywhere, it's there, but who makes room for him? Tough call.
So the only other one I'm thinking is, you're going to be surprised by this, but Ferrari.
Alpine. Oh, okay.
No, you don't mean that surprised. Like, yeah.
They've got the financial clout, you mean?
Well, again, if you've got, on the one hand, you've got Lewis. And as I said, I think Ollie Behrman is obviously, you know, part of their setup and would go there. On the other hand, you've got Charles. And to me, he's a driver that has all the talent to be a world champion and is waiting at Ferrari for them to have the car to do it. And if they can't progress this year at the start of a new set of regulations, I don't know the details, obviously the details of his contract, but I imagine he'd be someone that would just be touting around elsewhere to just see if this is his moment now. New regs, it's still not happening, if it's still not happening. And there could be an option to look elsewhere. And I think he would be an attractive signing for any of the other top teams. So then if you're Ferrari with a vacancy like a Leclerc, then I think you've got to go hard for Max. I don't see Max at McLaren. I see him definitely
even
at
with
Mercedes.
Lambiassi, even with Lambiassi moving to McLaren,
I think it would
he'd
only
beat work, him there.
I think it would only work if one of the McLaren drivers wanted out. I think McLaren had done a great job to keep their drivers happy. They're both performing to a good level. They are harmonious after everything last year as well. And I don't see management opting to sign Max over keeping Lando and Oscar. I think they've done a good job with the young lineup. So even if GP comes in, I think that's more for GP than it was to bring Max into the fold there. And I think I could see Max going to a big manufacturer, going to a Mercedes, or then does he take the latest big name driver to plunge to Ferrari and see if he can emulate Michael Schumacher and deliver a title there? And he's the sort of guy with all of these other qualities that possibly could galvanize them there.
The missing ingredient.
Who knows? Who knows? There's all so many ifs and buts, though, aren't there, with this?
Well, guys, finally, I just wanted to reflect on the Bahrain and Saudi Arabian Grand Prix, because these last two episodes of F1 Nation should have been reviews of those two races, which are no longer taking place in April due to the ongoing situation in the Middle East. But while we can't wait to go back to racing at Sakhir and Jeddah again, I thought it would be a good chance to just very quickly discuss our favourite memories of those two races over the years. Who wants to start? Bahrain.
I don't know how this is going to go over. Please take this as I mean it. Let me finish my thought before there's any judgment here. For me, when I think of Bahrain, rightly or wrongly, what comes to mind first and foremost is Grosjean's crash. And the reason I bring it up in this sense is because while the accident was horrific and everything, in how, you know, it's just so dramatic in how it played out, it was such a human moment. It was for me a really beautiful moment. The aftermath, you know, when he's out of the car, you see the emotion of everybody in pit lane. You hear from him after the fact. You see all the systems work, right? That was an accident that nobody should have survived, if I'm being totally frank. And the fact that, you know, he got himself out of the car, the design of the car, the people at the racetrack, you know, everything that had to go into making that a survivable incident for him. I just really saw the humanity of Formula One in a cutthroat world where everyone's out for each other at all times. There was this kind of beautiful reminder, a horrific thing that took it to come to the light, but a beautiful reminder of the humanity of the sport, and that even though everybody is fiercely competitive, we are all here. We are all human. We are all on the same page in the bigger picture of things. And so I know it's not a typical on-track moment to sort of, you know, memorialize in that sense. But for me, that's one of the most poignant moments that I've witnessed in racing.
I wish I'd gone first now. It's tough to follow on from that one.
You're like, yeah, but that great pass. That's like...
Yeah, exactly. Well, we've gone big picture now. Let's bring it back to a good dice I enjoyed once. Cheers.
Sorry.
So shall I go with the dice? 2022, let's bring it back to the racing. So I would say, obviously, 2014 is probably the one that you're expecting somewhere, TC, or that you've got up your sleeve with the Duel in the Desert. But I actually wasn't really watching it because I was racing in GP2 and I left. I think I was flying home and then I saw the highlights and I was like, wow, I wish I'd watched that. So for me, it was 2022 when you had the new regs last time, and you had Leclerc and you had Verstappen trading blows lap after lap. A pretty good race in Bahrain, and it's linked to Saudi as well, because then you had the same two the next week in Saudi having the same battle, and it was like, wow, new set of regs, so entertaining. You had Ferrari coming out on top just, but the fight between those guys was pretty special to watch. What do you reckon, TC?
Well, I did have 2014 up my sleeve, not only for that on-track battle, but also that was the first year that the Bahrain Grand Prix went under lights. First time it was a night race, and that was really exciting. It wasn't the first night race in Formula One history, because of course we'd had Singapore since 2008, but I thought the whole track looked fantastic under the lights. And then when we were gifted that amazing battle between those two Mercedes drivers, it was the perfect evening. Now, you referenced Saudi. Can we just a quick memory from Saudi, or I guess, are we all pointing in the same direction? 2021. Can I go first this time? That qualifying lap from Max that wasn't quite, what was he? He was quarter of a second up on Lewis Hamilton until he got to the final corner, locked up going in and kissed the wall, kissed probably a little bit more than that on the way out. But that was almost the perfect qualifying lap. And it summed up the drama of that stage of the 21 season perfectly for me.
Yeah. I've mentioned 22 already, but nothing will top 21 in Saudi. And actually just being in the paddock at the end of that year was a different feeling to anything I've felt since I've been in media. The tension that was different to anything last year as well. We had three drivers going for the title, but the Mercedes v Red Bull, Verstappen versus Hamilton, it was a war that had been waging all year. And then it came to a head in that race, didn't it? It was the race of many controversial moments. But you could just feel the jeopardy and the tension, and the whole paddock was just watching on at the box office stuff at the front.
Love them both. I mean, 22 was kind of the first one that came to mind, just because of, you know, the, like you say, the new rules, that great battle between Charles and Max. So I'll throw in an honorable mention then, since we've already said those two, which is Behrman's debut. Very impressive run, and, you know, could be known as the first race and the start of an incredibly long and storied F1 career.
Yeah, it was incredible. What did he qualified 11th, finished 7th.
Yeah.
Having been parachuted in on Saturday morning, replacing Carlos Sainz with his appendicitis. Well, guys, what a chat. Thank you both very much for your time. And this time next week, we will be previewing the Miami Grand Prix, because we're almost going racing again. But guys, thank you for your time. And for you listening at home, don't forget to check out F1's other official podcast this week. My guest on this week's episode of F1 Beyond the Grid is Cadillac test driver and F2 racer Colton Herta. That's out on Wednesday, and you can watch our chat on the F1 YouTube channel as well. And Colton's team principal at Cadillac, Graham Loudon, is answering your questions on the latest episode of F1 Explains. That's just below this show on the F1 Nation feed. Thank you very much for listening. As I say, we'll be back next Monday to preview the Miami Grand Prix. So we'll speak to you then. F1 Nation is produced by Formula One and Audioboom Studios.